everyone. It's a pleasure to be here at Maresfield Gardens, where I've spent so many happy hours in the photo collection and the library. So I'm very grateful to Shoshana and to Carol for having me here. As the inventor of psychoanalysis, Sigmund Freud cast a spell on the 20th century imagination. Analysis of human memory, a mysterious and ever-elusive phenomenon that invades all aspects of life, was one of Freud's overarching themes. It's important, of course, to us that he believed repressed memories were unconscious and that the most potent memories could emerge in psychoanalysis from deep inside via dreams and could not be arrived at by purely intellectual efforts. Freud's idea that we, quote, all dream predominantly in visual images, and that these images were transfigured through time but never really lost, is an important assumption for the visual culture of modernity. In what we might call the photochemistry of psychoanalysis, visual images, as a species of memory, would never simply disappear, even if they were consciously suppressed or unconsciously repressed. They could surface in the manifest or latent content of memories or dreams. Likewise, photographs and films, like this film still I'm showing you here from 1907 that we'll get back to a little later, were apprehended, like dream images, as a kind of exquisite visual residue, as traces taken mechanically from the continuum of lived experience, as in taking a picture. These days, we mostly agree that photographs are fabricated representations rather than captured truths. But the photo portrait is still frequently received as though the camera were a kind of insight machine, which somehow shows us the interior landscape of the sitter's mind. And I'm showing you here Freud's famous portrait over at the left by his son-in-law, the photographer Max Halberstadt, the right. And Max Halberstadt was married to Freud's daughter, Sophie. And here I show you Halberstadt in his study with some of his work around on the walls. And so one can say that in the golden age of photography, that is to say Freud's lifetime, that photography was everywhere. Freud used portrait photography in his personal life. And here I will show you quickly some of the photos that Freud kept close to him in his office and library, most of which, of course, are housed in this museum, very happily. So this cabinet card that I'm showing you now of Freud's professor in Paris, Jean-Martin Charcot of 1886, is inscribed to Monsieur Dr. Freud in memory of the Salpêtrière. This memento was long displayed in Freud's office in Bergasse 19. Casting a kind of benign eye over everything that happened there. So there was a certain amount of sympathetic magic associated with these photos. While studying in Paris, Freud kept a portrait of his fiancée, Martha Bernays, under lock and key in a desk drawer, and took it out only when the door was closed and he was alone. The door was locked, I should say, too. The photo had great agency in Freud's imagination, and it actually moved on its own, moved around, via sympathetic magic when he suspected the real Martha might be jealous or upset. The photograph even spoke to Freud, saying in his own words as he related them to Martha. The photograph is saying, "Patience, patience. I am but a symbol, a shadow cast on paper. The real person will return to you." At the same time, Freud demanded a family photo of Martha at age 2, which she sent to him in Paris around the same time, around 1886. This was a silly request from a man in love, but he wanted to possess all of Martha during their separation. They were engaged, but not yet. He was in Paris and she in Germany, if only in talismanic form. So the mythologies and magic of photography were alive and well in the life of Sigmund Freud, even though he proclaimed on numerous occasions that he was not a superstitious individual, and so on and so forth. But once he had a case of an interesting woman, an interesting case, and he said He wrote to Martha that her photo had been moving around and agitated, but there was nothing to fear because he loved only her. We all know that Freud availed himself of psychiatric photography. And here are a couple of the photographs of hysterical women under hypnosis made by Charcot's photographers at the Salpêtrière. So these images, very familiar to most of us by now, were intended as documentary material for the education of physicians, at least ostensibly. And I'll return to these in a little while. There's also more scientific diagnosis here in the portraits I'm showing you now. These are scenes from Freud's library, which is housed in this museum, of course, too. And what I'm showing you at the left is a patient with tertiary syphilis, nicknamed by Charcot the Mummy Man. And what I'm showing you at the right is a photograph of the mummy of Pharaoh Thutmose II in a book by the archaeologist Georg Steindorf, where the health and even the character of the king, talk about an insight machine, are discussed in terms of this mummified portrait. So it's a double seeing through to the truth, a transparent photograph seeing through to an actual, not a sculptured configuration of Thutmose, but his actual body. Archaeological and medical photographs, as per this example, spoke the same language in Freud's library. Now let's leave Paris and Cairo for Rome with the knowledge that for Freud and his contemporaries, the palindrome Roma Amor was a significant idea, and the desire for Roma, and Roma as a metonym for so many other concepts and things, fueled dreamers by day and by night throughout Europe and North America. So how do photographs take on the metaphorical guise of memories and daydreams in Freud's works? Well, reproducible images, like memories and dreams, are eminently portable, mutable, and bound up with desire. Freud recognized the fluid transportation of images in his own dream vocabulary of the 1890s, where Rome comes into play. In the first of the series of dream memories about a longing to visit Rome, Freud saw a view of the river Tiber and the Ponte Sant'Angelo from a train window. And I'm sure this passage will be familiar to many of you, but I'll just quote it again anyway. Quote, "I dreamed once that I was looking out of a railway carriage window at the Tiber and the Ponte Sant'Angelo. The train began to move off, and it occurred to me that I had not so much as set foot in the city. The view that I had seen in my dream was taken from a well-known engraving, which I had caught sight of for a moment the day before in the sitting room of one of my patients." So indeed, this particular view of the Tiber, and I'm showing you one here by, these were relatively older photographs from the sort of middle of the 19th century that were reproduced. This was by Giacomo Altobelli, who was a Roman photographer. And here you see, you know, the Dome of St. Peter's and Castel Sant'Angelo. And this was a favorite, absolute favorite view for engravers, photographers, and painters. And it was widely reproduced in Freud's day in various photographs and photogravures. It's important that the Rome dream view was also a great favorite of postcards sent from Viennese tourists in Rome back to Vienna, back home. These photographs were published time and again in postcards and stereoscopic view cards, as well as in books about history, art history, and travel. As Freud stated, it was a well-known composition, and he had probably seen it reproduced in many photographs, not merely once caught sight of for a moment in a patient's home. So the city of Vienna was saturated with this view, overdetermining the manifest and probably latent content of Freud's dreamscape. Here's Giacomo Brogi's picture of the same view, which Freud also owned. And you can see how limpid and kind of dreamy this is in its effect. You know, and it's, you can see where those fishermen are kind of, you know, it's practically a painting. It's a photograph, but it's very, very much retouched and very, very often republished. So what's most interesting about the frequently replicated view we're seeing here, we saw before, is that this particular composition could never have been visible from a train window. Nevertheless, it is reframed in that position within the condensed visual composition of Freud's dream. The view Freud glimpsed in the format of his dream was eminently photographic. Framed and yet fleeting, a beautiful vision, a synecdoche for the whole concept of Roma, an image that slipped away with the departure of the train, leaving the dreamer both anxious and desiring. Not only did Freud's personal dream feature a view of Rome from a moving train, he recommended the train window simile to the analyst treating a patient with free association. And I'll quote this. Many of you know this passage as well, but I'll quote it for you anyway. After the patient has made himself comfortable on the couch, the physician sits down behind him, and you can see the whole setup downstairs. This is so great speaking here because all the things are right on the premises. See that downstairs. Sits down behind him. "Please tell me what you know about yourself," he begins the first analytic session. "Say whatever goes through your mind. Act as though, for instance, you were a traveler sitting next to the window of a railway carriage and describing to someone inside the carriage the changing views you see outside." So in this example, visual modernism, which was so closely associated with trains rushing through landscapes and the still frames that were rushing by from train windows, here visual modernism and psychoanalytic modernism are inextricably linked, even though Freud's personal preference in art was always for a rather predictable kind of romantic classicism. Moving from the landscape to the body, I'd like to pose a simple question. How did Freud view naked women? Well, to answer that question, let's go back again from Rome to Vienna. Stefan Zweig was living in exile in Brazil when he wrote his memoir of Old Vienna. And in looking back, he described the life in the cafes of Vienna. And here's one of his comments. "Entire industries, which have perished today now that customs are more natural, flowered secretly. Art, and nude photographs in particular, were offered to half-grown boys for sale under the table by peddlers in every cafe." And I think these are the kind of, these are French postcards with the Viennese provenance that I found in Vienna. And I think this is exactly the kind of thing that he's talking about. And these are interesting because they're kind of, well, for many reasons, but also because of the body stocking effect you're seeing in both of these photos. It kind of makes the bodies look more like sculpture, or a little bit like sculpture, not totally like the imperfect flesh of a human being. Anyway, another category was that of the so-called academic nude photographs for the sale of artists. And under this pretext, photographic examples of living sculpture, as they called it, were circulated. Here, in examples like this, the visual tactic was to photograph nude models coated with a dusting of talc in the classical poses, or classical-like poses, to refer to Greco-Roman statuary. This is one of those. Steeped in the Western Greco-Roman tradition, these were part and parcel of the civilized convention of the heroic nude, male and female, which ostensibly belonged to the realm of classical history, all the way from the Greeks through Michelangelo, and thus precluded anything ignoble or erotic in their content. The Lebender Marmor, as these were called, living marble series, was circulated in German-speaking Europe throughout the later 19th century, and there were many different variations on this theme as well, including shows where in New York, for example, they had people dusted with talc standing on a rotating platform, and you'd see them when you went to the cinema, for example. In Times Square, you'd see a cinematic short, and you'd see these figures dusted in talc, and these people were praised for their ability to keep these classical poses, and so on and so forth. In fact, Freud himself probably spent more time gazing at pictures of nude statues in books, rather than looking at photos of women for sale under the table in cafes. Freud's library was crammed with illustrated books about Greco-Roman sculpture, which were filled with vivid, mysterious photographic illustrations, like the ones I'm showing you here, from statues of Aphrodite, who could come to life, to the castrating Medusa that you see on the right. And these illustrations are discussed at great length in my book, Mirrors of Memory, and so I will give them a short shrift right now. This evening, instead, I'd like to introduce the fact that the erotic silent films of Johann Schwarzer's Saturn Company were playing on a regular basis in Vienna from about 1906 to 1910. We don't know whether Freud's patients talked to him about these living photographs or not, but they were certainly advertised in the Neue Freie Presse and on placards throughout the city, periodically, frequently, and they were labeled as evening films for gentlemen only. So this film still is from one of them, and this is the film fragment called The Sculptor's Dream. As with Freud's famous indifference to André Breton and French Surrealism, the cinema seems to have been his natural ally, whether he liked it or not. And as Shoshana mentioned, he did not like it, period. However, I know of two occasions in which he went to the movies. He once went in New York in 1909 when he and Ferenczi were taken to a movie called The Happy Hooligan, a silent film called The Happy Hooligan, and Freud didn't like it. Ferenczi was enthusiastic. Freud apparently just sat there, poker-faced, naturally. And then another time in 1937, Freud was spotted at the Kreuzkino in Vienna with some young people. Apparently the young people were talking across him, and we don't know whether he liked that. It was a Hollywood feature. We don't know whether he liked it or not. So those are the only two times we know of when Freud attended the cinema. The association between Freud and cinema was especially vivid in the formula film equals dream equals unconscious. And the question of Freud and the cinema remains perplexing and irresistible. Many of Johann Schwarzer's Saturn films have deeply Freudian undertones, as I'd like to show you in a few examples that follow. So back to the theme of statues come to life, The Sculptor's Dream, here, of 1967, shows the sculptor in his studio. And you can see in the sculptor's studio, if you look at what's posted on that Biedermeier wallpaper over there, you can see that there is a large academic nude and some drawings from nude photographs and some casts, if you see those putti and then the arm reaching down, and then here are some classical busts around too. So it's a typical photographer's studio, even though it's posed here to be a sculptor's studio. This is eminently pertinent to the topic of the film, in which, after finishing a group of the classic Three Graces, as you see here, the sculptor rewards himself with a drink of champagne and dreams, or awakens to, the three nude statues come to life. And I think you can see these pretty well. I mean, they're very difficult. This is a very grainy, very early film in very bad shape, but here you can see how the statues have come to life. And they're approaching him, and the most beautiful of the Three Graces will kiss him, and then the other two of the Three Graces will beat him up. So it's a dream, but it's also a nightmare. Okay. In other words, they torment him. The audience always realizes that they are living women. So the sculptor is teased and tormented by his creations before falling asleep and waking again to an inanimate ensemble of marble statuary. Right, okay, so this is where I wanted to be. So speaking of statues come to life, the Pygmalion story, as related by Ovid, classical antiquity, was extremely popular in Freud's day around the turn of the 20th century, as is illustrated, as we see, for example, over at the left in this turn of the century, I think it's dated to 1898, this painting at the Metropolitan Museum in New York by Jerome Pygmalion and Galatea. And Freud, of course, analyzed the Pygmalion phenomenon in his study of Wilhelm Jensen's novel Gradiva in Freud's Delusions and Dreams of 1907. Speaking of Gradiva, This untitled film by Schwarzer about a shoe salesman deals with, and that's what we saw a film still from before, I showed it to you before, deals with shoes, stockings, legs, and glimpses under the skirt of a prosperous bourgeoise. See, she's having this shoe salesman come to her parlor and trying on the shoes. And it's pretty predictable stuff, you can imagine. But bare ankles and a flexed foot were the focus of Jensen and Freud's Gradiva as well. You'll recall that the archaeologist protagonist falls in love with the flexed foot. Whoops. Oh, I thought it was a pointer for a second, sorry. No, wait a minute. With the flexed foot of this Roman relief of a dancing girl. So it's a foot fetish. And this awakens the sexuality of the repressed archaeologist, who's the protagonist of Jensen's Gradiva, who was otherwise completely stifled and numbed by his academic career. So it took this figure to awaken his interest in sex, and which ended in his eventual marriage to a bourgeois German wife. Okay. Right. Day beds or couches were used in Freud's therapy sessions as well as in erotic photography. So what I'm showing you over at the left is a still from one of the Saturn films at the photographer's, and it takes place in a photographer's studio. You can see the photos for sale. It's probably Schwarzer's own studio, we must imagine. So they were used in both. In Schwarzer's film at the photographer's studio, 1908-10, a woman in déshabillé is posed on such a couch, probably to be photographed smoking and reading. Relaxations typically associated with masculinity and scandalous in women. So prostitutes, for instance, remember this is post Emma Bovary, prostitutes were assumed to have been spending their off-time hours lying around on daybeds or couches, reading novels and smoking cigarettes. And so reading was considered particularly dangerous. Reading novels was considered dangerous to a woman's mental health, and it could provoke hysteria or all sorts of things. But basically, that's the kind of image that would have been a still photograph. You see, it's a cinematic image of a still photograph being formed for sale to male customers. In the Saturn film called A Thrilling Chase, or A Thrilling Hunt, of 1967, we have a nude woman running through the countryside in search of her clothing, which is stolen while she's been swimming. So, very super predictable, right? So here she comes, and here are these Viennese out in the Wienerwald having a picnic or whatever, and here she comes. And then she crashes into them, and so upsetting everything, and... So you can see that it's got a comedic element to it, as do all of Schwarzer's Saturn films. They're not sexy in a contemplative way, they're sexy in a comedic way. And to underscore that comment, I'll just show you that, you know, it's gently erotic, it's a picnic with nude women, and so it's superficially related to Manet's Déjeuner sur l'herbe of 1863. But whereas Manet's painting that I'm showing you over at the right is uncannily tranquil and dignified, with allusions to Giorgione and to the classical world, Schwarzer's picnickers have an almost hysterical reaction to the intrusion of nudity. They panic in a comical manner, demonstrating a hectic, very anti-classical attitude toward nudity and nymphs. And what it is basically a comedy about the impropriety of the flesh more than anything else. In many cases, the act of voyeurism takes place on screen with the protagonist's gaze redoubled by that of the film's spectators. The power of hypnosis, with the stilted furniture and lace curtains of a typical Biedermeier interior, where they're here, is a good place to begin. Middle-aged bourgeois man visits a woman, presumably his mistress or a prostitute, in her sitting room wanting to make love to her. She proceeds to hypnotize her lover subject and then undresses to a transparent black-trimmed body stocking, Her attire, as you see it here, including the requisite shoes and stockings, of course, is a costume of sexual display. But the gentleman in question is not able to enjoy it. And why not? Because he's in a trance. Here she is hypnotizing him, putting him into a hypnotic state. And she's still dressed, although dressed in a domestic kind of house coat. And under her suggestion, he has succumbed to a hypnotic trance. So his eyes are closed to the immediate world. This act of voyeurism is a trick to be enjoyed not by the male protagonist, who's out of it, but by the spectators who laugh at a man who cannot perceive the carefully staged nakedness that's in front of his own closed eyes and in front of theirs. While he's in a trance, under the influence of hypnosis, the woman liberates him of his wallet and plays other humiliating tricks on him. And her butler, or younger lover, enters and exits the scene periodically to assist her with her trickery, implying that not only is the client, a dupe, but he also might be a cuckold, and probably is. The power of hypnosis might be interpreted as an object lesson about the extent to which an established gentleman, Viennese gentleman, could be enthralled by his mistress to his own detriment and be made to look ridiculous or even ruined financially. But in fact, the visual focus is still on the woman's body. So the audience is smarter and more conscious than the protagonist. And the audience, no matter whether she's got the upper hand in the situation or not, she's still naked for the benefit of the people in the audience. Still, Schwarzer's power of hypnosis certainly demonstrates a gender flip of Georges de Maurier's novel Trilby of 1894. In Trilby, a devious Jewish musician called Svengali hypnotizes an innocent artist model named Trilby in order to exploit her talents. This is an illustration from the first edition of Trilby. Although not hysterical, Trilby is subject to violent headaches and malaise, and she's cured of an attack by Svengali's mesmerizing powers. So here's, where I work, this would be the pointer. So there's Svengali with exaggerated Jewish features hypnotizing Trilby, the innocent artist's model. And the melodrama goes on from there. A decade later, in 1904, Trilby was made into a British silent movie directed by Harold Shaw. In fact, a spate of hypnosis films were produced in the first decade of the 20th century, including Pathé's The Hypnotic Wife of 1909 and D.W. Griffith's Criminal Hypnotist of the same year. In fact, 1909 was a year filled with silent films about hypnosis. Not all of them still exist. Many are, have perished in one thing and another. But in looking over the lists of films that were made by places, Pathé, Thomas Edison, and the major film companies, there were many, many films made on the subject of hypnosis, and among those, plenty on the subject of criminal hypnosis. So in addition to the fact that cinema itself was a hypnotic medium, Schwarzer's Saturn films have obvious Freudian associations. The power of hypnosis presents a humorous and bizarre twist not only to the Svengali scenario, but also it reverses the gender roles of the hysterical female patients hypnotized by doctors who were Freud's teachers, people like Bernheim, Tourette, and Charcot. And these are super familiar to everyone. There is Dr. Charcot, and that's Joseph Babinski with a woman fainting in his arms. At a demonstration, part of a larger painting by André Brulet. And this is shows a lethargic state of a hypnotized woman, and probably much more likely she would have been, she doesn't have her bodice slipping down and she's being held up by a female nurse, which was probably more to the point on an everyday basis. That's a bit classicized. Charcot's team at the Salpêtrière hypnotized women, hysterical, abject, out-of-control women, as we could see them photographed here by Paul Regnard, while Freud was a resident there. We are reminded of Freud's review of August Forel's Hypnotism of 1889 and his own writings on hypnosis from 1891 and 1893, very early publications by Freud on hypnosis. In terms of medical treatment, Freud followed the experiments of Forel, Bernheim, Charcot, and Tourette with great attention, but also a certain amount of critique. So Freud himself, in his own writings about hypnosis, invites a gendered reading, because he stated that hypnosis worked best when conducted tête-à-tête, in a darkened room, with the subject's clothing loosened. And he stressed that women were more easily hypnotized by light and ocular fixation than men. And he said, as soon as a woman practically walks into an eye exam, she's subject to being hypnotized. So next time you go for an eye exam, see if you can fall into a trance of ocular hypnosis. It didn't work for me, but it might work for somebody else. The concept of criminal hypnosis, including hypnotic seduction, was a matter of serious debate in medical communities in Paris and Vienna. Although Freud theorized and practiced hypnosis to some extent, he always warned against the abuse of this technique, cautioning, as he surely was, and cautioned by staged demonstrations of mesmerism in Vienna that were super famous around the world, or the Jewish stereotyping of Svengali, among other cultural factors, including this demonizing cartoon of Charcot, which shows Charcot as the evil hypnotist coming out of his death's head. But of course, and this is really important for Freud studies, one of Freud's great contributions to psychiatric practice was to reject hypnosis in favor of psychoanalysis. So patients weren't under, they were awake, but they were in a kind of netherworld where they were conscious and fully aware of what they were saying and doing. The Viennese physiologist Josef Breuer used hypnotic suggestion in the famous Freudian case of Anna O, which for the first time established hysteria and its treatment via hypnotism in the German-speaking world, and initiated the talking cure for psychosomatic paresis and other neurotic problems. Anna O was a pseudonym for Bertha Pappenheim, here she is, and portrayed as a young woman, who suffered from hysterical coughing, paresis, and hallucinations in the wake of her father's death from a tubercular tumor. During the course of her treatment, which was from 1880 to 1882, Dr. Breuer, and here's good old Josef Breuer, visited Bertha Pappenheim at her elegant home on a nearly daily basis. She was medicated under medication with chloral hydrate, and that's described even in postmodernity as a sedative hypnotic drug. And under induced hypnotic suggestion, Pappenheim hallucinated images such as a frightening black death's head and snakes. These were the same hallucinations that some of the hysterics at the Salpêtrière had also envisioned, big black snakes crawling over the floor. And Bertha Pappenheim saw phantasms of death heads and mirrors as if envisioning her father's ghost. Meanwhile, she had nursed her father for years through a very grave illness, and she was sort of obsessed with his illness and his demise. Mirrors, like photographs and films, we remember, were transformative mediums. In the course of this intimacy, Bertha formed an amorous attachment or transference to her doctor, even imagining that she was pregnant with Breuer's child. At this point, the doctor fled, although he later narrated the complicated case to Freud, who published it in 1895. We know something about Bertha Pappenheim's attachment to Josef Breuer via Freud, but Breuer left the scene and never explored the phenomenon of erotic countertransference as such. And you can hardly blame him for leaving the scene, because he would have been under tremendous accusations of having interfered with this young woman. A doctor's emotional entanglement with a patient, which was played out in the setting of a domestic interior, amongst lingerie, chloral hydrate, and mirrors, could give rise to erotic fantasy, as does the Saturn film that I'm showing you a still from now over at the left, called The House Caller, The House Doctor, The House Artist, of 1907, in which a patient with an imaginary or hysterical illness seduces her doctor. So in The House Call, the doctor reports to a well-appointed home where he is alone with the patient who's on a couch, And here are, I'm going to show you some still photos from the house call. Here is the patient undressing for the medical visit. So she's a malingerer and she undresses for the medical visit, but really she's in love with the doctor. And here is the morphological examination where the doctor listens, I guess, to her heart, is tapping on her back. And the reason I show you that film still is because I want to compare it to this hysteric and treatment from the Salpêtrière. I don't know which doctor that is. I don't know who it is, whether it's Tourette or someone else. But you can see that in visual terms, these are very much alike. In Schwarzer's cinema, the malingerer progressively slips away her nightdress and virtually offers her body to the doctor, as you see at the left. Although lacking the morbid hallucinations of Anna O, the Saturn film production has the quality of an uncanny daydream, where we might question as to whether certain things are actually happening. And presumably they're happening during the day, an effect that was enhanced by the fact that in silent films they filmed with glass roofs so the natural daylight would come in. And so you have streams of daylight streaming in and bizarre things happening. So that's sort of true of many of the Saturn films. So it's a kind of, well, it's kind of like Jensen's novel about Gradiva, where weird things happen at noontime, at the sunniest part of the day. Anyway, given Schwarzer's personal métier, which was studio photographer, it's no surprise that the semi-nude patient in this boudoir setting resembles an art postcard of the time that I'm showing you at the right by the Viennese photographer Hermann Schiebert. And that's another one of those photographs that would have been for sale at cafes or wherever. Very popular. It's meant to be an academic nude to help art students study the human figure, but it's basically, as you can see, it's very romantic and classical and sexy at the same time. Berta Pappenheim recovered from her illness some years after her treatment and became an active intellectual and social reformer, particularly in turn-of-the-century women's issues. So let this lead us into the Sklavenmarkt, or slave market, films by the Saturn Company, of which they were several. Here's Berta Pappenheim, and I show you a still from the slave market. These Saturn films, by the way, are housed in the Filmarchiv Wien in Vienna. These erotic scenarios reverted to Orientalist themes, such as harem girls and young women inspected for sale as slaves. That's what's happening here, and you can see that it's a very makeshift kind of cardboard yurt that they've set up. It's a very simple film setting, and of course it's filmed outdoors, so that's easier. There's plenty of natural daylight, and you just have people disappearing behind the curtain into that yurt that's set up there. And you can see the Sultan is sitting on the, this is again probably filmed in the Wienerwald or something like that. The Sultan or Pasha sitting down and he's having these women brought to him. You can see he's inspecting this one. He has her, his assistant holding up her dress so he can examine her body. And I'm comparing her body in, oh yeah, I also wanted to point out that you see a kind of strange halberd behind that woman's body and it's got the eight-pointed star on top and that's the set in trademark of the Saturn Film Company. So that was a way that Johann Schwarzer wanted to have his films be identified. If you didn't see the eight-pointed star, then it wasn't an authentic Saturn film. And that's going to become pertinent a little later when I show you some other different kind of images. So anyway, I'm just comparing that with this typically Orientalist photograph of a Nubian woman from Egypt around the turn of the century. These erotic scenarios reverted to Orientalist themes, and the voyeuristic frisson in these was enhanced by the exotic lure of the East, or the East at least in the fictitious European representation. Now the thrill was also underscored, and this is not so evident to a 21st century person, by the fact that sexual slavery existed in Europe in the early 20th century and was considered a great social problem. It exists in the 21st century as well, I might add, but it was definitely much written about in newspapers at the turn of the 20th. slave market again. The Oriental harem and slave fantasy was an erotic staple of 19th century European painting and photography. And this master-slave scenario undermined the bourgeois husband-wife relationship that prevailed as an ideal in industrialized Europe. So there has been a great deal of writing about these Orientalist representations, from Edward Said to Linda Nochlin and so on and so forth. But I'm just refreshing your memory with this painting by Jérôme, The Slave Market. She's having her teeth inspected, as you can see. And again, the Nubian woman in this French postcard from Egypt. So non-European women were sexualized in exotic settings. Western women were bought and sold and brought into captivity in the harem. And these were the two current historical currents that were going on during the Saturn films. And this is all the standard material of colonial fantasy. But for the now healthy and very feminist Bertha Pappenheim, the former Anna O, white slavery, or the forced prostitution of young Jewish girls from Eastern Europe, was a real political concern. Young women from Galicia and Eastern Poland, where Jews were uneducated, poor, and subject to attack, were among the victims of slavery. Desperate parents purportedly sold their daughters into the slave prostitution trade. Men promising marriage abducted Jewish girls in Eastern Europe with promises of, marry me and we'll go to Germany, or marry me and we'll have a life together in America. I have a job set up. And instead, these girls were brought to Odessa on the Black Sea and conveyed to Jewish slave dealers in Istanbul, who would then sell them to men who brought them to Cairo and Alexandria. And there were a lot of Jewish girls sold into prostitution that went to Argentina as well at the same time. But the more spectacular examples were going to the East to be in these kind of, well, probably more a house of prostitution, but a harem of some kind of pasha or something like that, as it was imagined. So Pappenheim's mission was to inspire the rabbis of Eastern Europe to recognize that this terrible slave trade was going on and to condemn it. So in 1911-12, Bertha Pappenheim, the former Anna O, traveled east to the brothels of Salonika, Istanbul, Jerusalem, Cairo, and Alexandria to find Jewish girls and rescue them from sexual slavery. If she was hysterical about sex in her youth, Pappenheim developed into a serious feminist in her later years, and they may be different sides of the same coin or not. But once she recovered well. Now, so far we've seen a rich strain of Freudian connections permeate the form and content of these erotic films, with their make-believe sultans and slaves, their photographers, picnickers, bourgeois interiors, zoftig women, shoe salesmen, and entertaining but harmless hypnotists. But one thing you may have noticed is that these photographic pictures and filmic pictures contrast the avant-garde painting of the time. The Saturn films do not overtly disclose any stylistic or narrative affinity for sexual anxiety or melancholy or alienation, as, say, we find in the works of Viennese artists like Gustav Klimt or Egon Schiele, as I'm showing you in these two drawings here. Nor is there the morbid sadism, masochism, or narcissism that the Austrian expressionists were so concerned with. One thing you'll indeed have noticed is that sex in Saturn films consists mainly of looking at healthy bodies. None of the characters are sadistic or violent. None of them seem lonely, sadistic, or alienated. And the films are all in some way comedic. There's an element of comedy meant for a male audience to appreciate in numbers, a certain, you know, for gentlemen only, or black evenings where men would be in tux and tails, and they'd be laughing together at these very brief films in social settings. They were usually shown by itinerant film projectors in places like the Prater in Vienna, places like that. But you can see, as we already saw in The Sculptor's Dream, the classical ideal of the nude figure remains inviolate in Schwarzer's world. So arrows for arrows, what can we make of that? Do Saturn films exemplify the lighter side of humanity's darker side? Do they represent just another facet of bourgeois decorum, with everything in its proper place and meant to stay that way? Do they remain on the surface of what psychoanalysis was meant to excavate? Well, I'd like to complicate that question by pointing out that Saturn screenings were not necessarily single features. In fact, sensational slides and films of disturbing medical oddities and actual films of surgery frequently accompanied Saturn showings. So Saturn films were accompanied by painful humiliations of the flesh, like the separation, like we're seeing here. This is a film made by Dr. Eugene Doyen of his separation of conjoined twins from South Asia. And they lived for a little while after they were separated by Eugene Doyen, but they didn't live for too long after that. They were conjoined at the sternum, very difficult. So Saturn films were accompanied by these kind of very sensational medical photos and films. The French surgeon Eugene Doyen, and here he's just taking some stitches out so we can relax in this one, was the first to film his procedures for documentary purposes. And they were not meant for entertainment in the theaters or fairgrounds of Paris or Vienna or New York. But Doyen's films were apparently hijacked for that purpose anyway, since there was a lot of money to be made from morbidity in entertainment. Here's one, a still from one of Doyen's films that shows surgery of the jaw. And this kind of reminded me, too, when I saw it, I immediately thought of the portrait of the elderly Freud, who had so many operations on his jaw by the time he was in his last years and he was in constant pain. And this brings that fact home really very graphically. Freud had many operations for cancer of the jaw. And there was also, cranial surgery was also thrilling enough for the movies, as we see in this film still. And this is kind of strange, too, because the head is being operated on. But it looks like, this black ribbon is to cover the patient's eyes, I think. But what it looks like is that his skull is being lifted right off the top of his neck. And so it's particularly, you know, these were sensational things. These were advertised as for gentlemen only. Women and children were too delicate to see these things. Okay. Meanwhile, another form of film surgery, this time fictional, was paired with the Saturn films for the erotic delectation of male viewers. The fact that some of these surgical images were scientific and others, like the one I'm showing you here, I believe, were posed, complicated the process of beholding by the curious eye. The scientific documentaries, like those of Doyen, seem to have inspired the film stills that I'm going to show you now, where at least I think, I'm convinced, that the doctors and surgical patient are actors. I'd be very grateful for your feedback on any of these as I show them to you. So here in this film, which is called Eine schwierige Behandlung, The Difficult Treatment, which may or may not be by Johann Schwarzer, the woman is supposedly unconscious. Some say she's meant to be dead. And her body, which is nude except for the usual shoes and stockings, is objectified, inspected, handled, and operated on by the two doctors. Here's another still from that same film, A Difficult Treatment. And you can see that these films are somehow crossing the line. They're not so much fun anymore. They're not things you would laugh at unless you were, you know, in a situation of viewing these as pornography, actually. So these cross the line from something very funny and amusing and Biedermeier and fluffy, you know, whipped cream Vienna, to something that's quite a bit more difficult to take. So if any of you knows anything at all about this film or others like it, I'd be very grateful if you could tell me. Let's see, I have one more here. Yeah. So there's this one. So we have moved from classicism to orientalism, and from erotic comedy to erotic morbidity. And we've arrived at a new question. Namely, what was the impact of medical imaging with relation to sex and the forbidden in visual culture? So let me conclude by reversing the terms for a moment and consider the context of psychoanalysis in the popular culture of silent cinema. In a single evening, indeed probably less than half an hour, much shorter time than this lecture has taken, Viennese filmgoers moved from the fun and games of nudity in the countryside, or a Viennese bourgeois showing her breasts to her doctor in a gemütlich warmth of her sunlit home, to a kind of uncanny equation between medicine, sadism, and the female body as an unconscious, anonymous object. In the stills we see from this production, A Difficult Treatment, it seems that sadistic sex, anxious sex, has arrived in popular culture, and we are suddenly in a colder and darker realm. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mary. Some questions? A lot to digest. Yes, Michael?
Thank you very much for that.
Fascinating
lecture, Liz. These skills here remind me, I was wondering where you got them from, because I've seen them reproduced in a catalogue, in a recent catalogue. Is that really?
Well, I saw them reproduced in a catalogue about the Saturn films. And it was a catalogue that was Michael Achenbach and his colleague, Paolo Canepele, wrote this monograph on the Saturn films. And the Saturn films were shown in an installation at the Neue Galerie in New York in this most recent show, Vienna 1900. So that may be where you saw these reproduced too, although I'm not sure. But one thing about these is that nobody seems to know very much about them. And even Achenbach and his colleagues are just guessing as to what these were. And I showed these to a friend the other day who was convinced that these were really scientific films and said, what is pornographic about them? It's just a gynecological surgery. So I don't know how they strike anyone here or how...
I think the caption to the one I saw, and I think it was in a catalogue called Kino im Kopf, and it was an exhibition of cinema.
Oh, let me write that down.
I can trace that up. And I think the caption said it was a different view of this chair, and they said it was something to do with demonstrating the mechanics of this gynecological chair.
Probably. Oh, I'd love to see that. I mean, that sounds very interesting. And we know that Méliès, for example, the great silent filmmaker who, the movie Hugo is about Méliès, I believe. I haven't seen Hugo, but Méliès made films of operation, surgical procedures that were subsequent to Dr. Doyen, and they were spoofs on Doyen. But I have never seen those films, and I haven't been able to find any extant ones. But maybe somebody here knows where those can be seen as well.
Anything else?
There was actually a second after.
Yes?
Sorry. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Am I interrupting?
No, no. There is no...
As I said, the captions said they were demonstrating the mechanics of the chair. And there's the whole aspect of the mechanics of cinema, which, I mean, that did strike Freud, I know, because at one point in one of his letters, he's writing on the ship and his writing is jerky. And he said, my writing has been kinematographized.
Ooh, that's nice.
So, I mean, this is in 1909.
Yeah.
And he obviously been struck by the jerkiness of the film. And, I mean, he is concerned about the whole mechanics of making photos again.
Mm-hmm.
In still photos, because somewhere there, I can't quite remember where, he talks about the negative, the capture of an image from a negative. He uses that as an analogy for mental processes.
Yes.
So the jerkiness was something that struck him.
That's lovely. And that was before he even went to the silent movie in the States, which he was on his way to the States.
He was on the boat, on the coming back from the States.
Oh, coming back from the States. So that's very nice, yeah.
And I think he invented the verb to can imagine it.
That's wonderful. Yeah, it's Ernest Jones, I guess, who tells us that Ferenczi was quite keen on watching the Happy Hooligan movies, which were just totally slapstick, and that Freud was less enthusiastic, as you might imagine.
Well, I think actually that this is Ernest Jones sort of projecting the image of the master, because
exactly.
Freud did actually see some outdoor projections of not movies, but stills projected in the open.
Oh, yes, in Rome, yeah.
And he says how he was enjoying it.
Right.
And he's writing to his family.
Right,
saying,
of course.
You know, I'm enjoying it as well as the little children was.
Right. So. And those were films, they were put on by the Italian Association of Advertising.
Yeah.
And they showed scenes from, you know, exotic cultures like Congo, as well as Italian monuments and sculptures and things like
yeah.
that.
It sounds like he enjoyed that.
Yeah, exactly.
Can you assume that Freud saw any of this?
I don't think so. I mean, he might have, but what I'm talking about is kind of taking the pulse of the times, and certainly if he didn't see them, his patients must have. Some of his patients must have seen them.
But not the women.
Well, it's not clear whether they were advertised for gentlemen only. First, they were advertised for adults only. Then for gentlemen only. Then they were considered black evenings. And in Trieste, for example, that was the Italian part of the Austrian Empire, they were called serate nere. So they were called that because men would be dressed all in black, the audience would be in black. But we don't know whether women went to see those things too. How can we know? You know, I don't have any evidence that women didn't go to those Herrn Abende and see the Saturn films as well. I don't know. And we also know that in bordellos, there was true pornography, and there were pornographic films shown, you know, handmade pornographic films shown in brothels and bordellos, so people saw them there as well during the same exact time period.
So if you had to sum up, you know, the essence of how photography might have shaped Freud's thinking, What did he say? I mean, he didn't see these films. He saw the medical, archaeological, and family photographs, right? These are the three sources?
He saw many, many photographs. Many, many. And his illustrated library, as a matter of fact, is in this museum. So if you want to set eyes on the photographs that Freud looked at, you can get them here. You can look at them here. Many of which are in archaeology books on Egyptian archaeology. I showed you the Thutmose II pharaoh and some medical photographs and so on. So he was very acquainted with that kind of photography, and you know, I think one can only imagine that what was happening in Vienna at that time has not so much a causal effect. It's not cause and effect, but I think, as Peter Gay once said, you know, we can just sort of sit back and let psychoanalysis inform these things for us. You know, there doesn't have to be a causal relationship. Freud was influenced by this, or Freud's patient was a dream was influenced by a Saturn film, or anything like that. At least I don't know of any specific cause and effect kind of things, except where Freud talks about his own dreams of Rome and so on and so forth.
Mm.
But I do think that he must have gone for evening walks in the Prater once in a while, and must have seen these itinerant cinemas, and who knows? You know, we basically don't know who saw those films. It didn't take very long to see them because they were so short. And now they're in terrible condition, so they're even more short and fragmentary. They just sort of appear and disappear like that. But presumably, Viennese people of the bourgeoisie saw those films. They were everywhere.
Question? I can't remember what they called the, you know, the early photography. There was a lot of indistinct photography, which was connected with spiritualism.
Yes.
Spirit.
Curlian photography.
What is it?
Curlian photography.
There were spirit photographs.
But I mean, that was, in a way, the unconscious as well, wasn't it? There was a link.
Yeah, of course it was, and I've just finished a book on Proustian photography where I talk about spirit photographs and how, for example, in Proust's novel, the Jewish guy Bloch, who becomes a critic and so on and so forth, when he glides into a room, it's like he's like the Prince of Arabia or these various, he's described in different ways as Turkish Sultan, you know, because his features were so oriental for being a French, he wasn't really French, he was Jew. That whole theme was being explored. And so all of that comes from spirit photography, where you have, say, you know, the photograph of an individual and his or her cosmic other or their. You know, in the United States, for example, there were films of black people with their African ancestors coming out in spirit form. And many of the spirit photographs that were taken in England and the US, especially in New England, had Orientalist themes to them as well. Spirit photographs usually had, frequently would show somebody in an Oriental, kind of like a burnous kind of thing. It could either be their shroud, you know, post-mortem, or it could be a kind of Oriental costume that they were, you know, harking back to some remote ancestor in biblical times or something like that. So that was very much the spirit of spirit photos.
There's two areas of photography that might be relevant. One is earlier on, all the images that people made of dead babies.
Yes.
And as possibly a memorial thing, possibly tinges of some sort of erotization or something. And also in the 20s, later on, work by Eric Salomon and so on, these exposés, you know, people's fantasies about politicians and so on. And he took these very sort of intimate pictures of politicians falling asleep and playing cards and jaws hanging open on trains and secret negotiations. So there's sort of a voyeuristic thing about people who are really quite famous and the fantasies sort of the masses have about them.
Absolutely. And let's face it, photography is a voyeuristic medium, as film is. I mean, that word comes instantly to mind. Now, I think the daguerreotypes of the dead children, I don't think they were, maybe they were circulated at a later date for erotic purposes, but they were basically meant to, I mean, it's a very close, photography and death had that very close connection right in 1839 when Daguerre invented photography, where you would memorialize a dead person by making a photograph of them. And so since infant mortality rate was very high back then, at least in the US and North America, you know, there are a lot of, many of the daguerreotypes we find are of cadavers.
I think the point you made about the window of the train, you know, how we frame the world, we bring it into our own sort of surveillance or control. And I think that says something about the still image, because, you know, Sontag talks about cinema, one image cancels the preceding
one. Exactly.
And so if you have a still image, it's much more a way of sort of framing and hanging on to this stuff.
That's right. And in fact, many of the, let's say, authors of the turn of the century, Marcel Proust for one, talks about these framed, sitting on a train and watching these framed images clicking by in succession. And it, whether it's before cinema was invented or after, it has the idea of the aestheticized film still. And many people, when they travel on a train, I think even to this day, have that experience of kind of like framed views rushing by. And that's modern and cinematic. And so that was very peculiar that Freud used that example in describing his own dream, which was a view from a train window that couldn't have been. It was a view transported to that. And also his ideas about psychoanalysis. Let the patient observe as if a series of views were coming by and on a train ride. So that's eminently modernist thinking.
And the train thing is also voyeuristic, because the observing passenger, you know, their gaze, they're inside and this stuff is outside.
Right, and don't forget the first time Freud saw his mother in the nude, it was on a train, right? And he can only frame that in terms of, in Latin, he can only write with the classical language about that, calling it matrem nudum. He doesn't dare write about it in German. So, yeah.
Thank you.
those ideas about what came before and what came after, I was actually thinking at the same time that there were so many things shooting off sideways in my thinking while I was reading the book, which is a kind of a good endorsement of the book, that actually these things were going on simultaneously. It isn't a question of before and after.
Right, yeah.
And in photography, I have a personal prejudice that art tells us more about psychology than psychology ever can,
mm-hmm.
And a lot earlier as well.
Mm-hmm.
But simultaneously throughout the second half of the 19th century, there was a sort of split in the world of photography, and people were sort of dropping into factions with things like the photo secession and things like
right.
that, between the people who were very alert to ideas of everything I'm doing is really consciously manipulated, so they were
right.
cutting up glass plate negatives like
mm-hmm.
O.G. Raylander
yeah.
and sticking the bits together, or deliberately sort of going into a sort of semi-trance-like state while making images like Peter Henry Emerson in East Anglia, that there were exactly those ideas of the conscious and the unconscious evolving in the world of photography without having an explicit language to express this, other than the print,
right.
as was developing in psychoanalysis.
Right.
Well.
And those were the avant-garde photographers who talked about things like that, which is interesting, because we can only assume that Freud probably didn't like avant-garde photography very much. He didn't like André Breton very much, and I showed you Breton's self-portrait where he's making fun of science and looking through a microscope at all these leaping little horses jumping around and everything, and that's the kind of thing that would have absolutely driven Freud crazy. He didn't like anything that was sort of disrespectful toward medical scholarship or classical culture.
Yes, in the back. Would you like to stand up so that we can hear you?
I was just wondering, to what extent, you know, that you touched on it earlier when you said that you were trying to photograph the location in this room, and you asked for a photograph, a younger photograph of his fiance. I was just wondering, to what extent do we know that the Freud or analysts used photography actually in their work? Would they ask them to bring such kind of things in, you know, or would they ask them to bring in visual material? Would it involve them in their work, or would they help them, rather than just being something that they were immersed in?
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating question. I don't know the answer to it, but I think it's well worth looking into, because most people, and even there was a social psychologist, a North American social psychologist called Stanley Milgram. And he wrote a book in the 1950s stating that people still, he was doing scientific sociological experiments stopping people in the street. And he said most Americans in 1955 or whenever it was believed that what they saw in a photograph was actually happening or had actually happened. So there's all this stuff about incredulity, and people didn't really believe that they were seeing the real thing in a photograph. But people to this day, when they open a newspaper and they see a photograph, they sort of expect that they're seeing the real thing in some way. So I think that's a very interesting question, because if they were seeing the real thing, if there was that credulity involved, then the doctor could get to know the patient so much better, and especially by looking into early childhood, which would have a lot to do with psychoanalysis. So thank you for pointing that out.
I'm afraid our time is up now.
We
need to get out, Carol.
We have
one last question.
But very short.
Okay.
The relation with the archaeology,
yes.
And photography,
yeah.
You explained, it's related to the inspiration of the photographer to ancient art. All it is, I mean, all the.
Well, these photographs were, if you look at the archaeology books
yes.
of the time, there are quite a few in this collection. Rodenwald, for example, was a German archaeologist who wrote the Propylaeon book on Greek and Roman art. The photographs in there, I mean, the illustrations are ostensibly just supposed to show you what the work of art looks like for archaeological purposes. But in fact, it draws you into a kind of mood of, you know, the technique of chiaroscuro is used overwhelmingly, and fragmentation, and you have feelings of fragmentation in the past. So the whole mood of archaeology and classical mythology gets kind of colored by these images. And you also had people like
a sort of imagery to imagine.
Yeah.
An inspiration they had for ancient art in general, for doing this photography. Do you mean?
I'm not quite sure I understand your question.
So they took an inspiration from these photographies for doing this.
For practicing archaeology?
From this archaeology, for these images of archaeology for doing the photography. This is what you mean.
I think she's saying being archaeology-inspired photography.
So archaeology-inspired.
Yeah. I would say that the photography of archaeology, which was, okay, now I understand, which basically these early photographers were photographing silent models that didn't move. So the photography of sculpture and archaeological photography was one of the first really important and interpretive kinds of photography. You're absolutely right. So that it could be a huge field of experimentation as it was. I mean, those photographs are so emotional. And surely they, like as I tried to show in one of the examples here, and I do discuss in my book, looking at a photograph of the Aphrodite of Syracuse that I showed you from a very common archaeology book, it could be something the surrealists would come up with because she was headless, right? Women are headless in surrealism. She was headless, and she could come to life. So I think your point is very well observed that those early photographers who were doing this supposedly utilitarian photography of recording ancient statuary were really opening the door to, definitely, to what the surrealists would end up doing, for sure. It's very interesting.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for coming, and thank you, Mary.